from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Most Latter-day Saints will remember Thomas S. Monson as a storyteller. He had a million of them, about widows being cared for and trips to hospitals, stories about his funny or wise neighbors, and in some ways they were exactly what a believer wants out of a prophet, simple pastoral stories about the basics. But it could also be said that members of a growing institution being buffeted by social change also need something more assertive and vigorous from a leader. And most agree that wasn't Thomas Monson. He was president during one of the most controversial eras of Mormonism, and of most of those controversies, he didn't say a word publicly. Monson died Tuesday at the age of 90, and today in the program, we're talking about his legacy and about the condition in which he left the church for the future. Join us after the news.
Happy New Year from KUER.
Thanks for all of your support.
Happy 2018.
Happy New Year.
Cheers to 2018.
It's Doug Fabrizio. Thank you very much for your support and Happy New Year.
I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, and thank you for helping to make 2017 a year of great conversations. Here's to 2018, hoping it's healthy and happy for you and yours.
Happy New Year.
And you can still support us for the year ahead at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the modern cycle of LDS presidents, you often have these long periods with a visionary, energetic leader, followed by these shorter terms by more passive prophets. They're usually referred to as placeholder presidents by observers. This less active period of leadership is usually just a matter of circumstance more than anything, the age and health of the man. And there are those who may describe the past 9 years or so of Thomas S. Monson's leadership as one of those passive periods, which is not to say there wasn't a lot going on in the church. There is. It continues to grow, continues to build temples. There were at least two prominent controversies that marked the last few years: the movement of Mormon feminists asking for more power and responsibility in the church, if not the priesthood itself, and a policy in 2015 which labeled same-sex Latter-day Saints as apostates and deprived their children of membership in the church. For whatever reason, Thomas Monson chose to say nothing publicly or directly about those controversies, and his health, probably some form of dementia, held him back for at least the last few years. Thomas S. Monson died on Tuesday at the age of 90, and today in the program we're going to look back on his presidency and then look forward to the man who will replace him. You can join us if you like, if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us this part of the program is Patrick Mason. He's back with us. He's an historian, the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University in California. He's a member of the LDS Church. And his latest book is called What is Mormonism? A Student's Introduction. He's joining us from a studio at Claremont. And Patrick Mason, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Good morning, Doug.
Gregory Prince is back with us. He's an independent historian and an active Latter-day Saint. He has written biographies of LDS Church President David O. McKay and of the church historian Leonard Arrington. He has a forthcoming book called Mormons and Gays, and he's joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. And Gregory Prince, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Doug. Nice to be back.
Andrea Radke Moss is also joining us, a professor of history at Brigham Young University, Idaho. She writes about Mormon women's history, contributes to the Mormon history blog Juvenile Instructor. She's also an active Latter-day Saint and is joining us from her home in Rexburg, Idaho. And Andrea Radke Moss, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on again, Doug.
Patrick Mason, I want to begin with you because you said something to our producer earlier this week, I'm not sure when it was exactly, that you said found it interesting that there aren't really scholars of Thomas S. Monson, that there's something about his persona or his leadership or his administration that hasn't really lent itself to that. Let's begin there, because I think it's an interesting way of explaining what we make of Thomas S. Monson. What do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, scholars are drawn to strong and forceful personalities, people who they see are real agents of change in the world, who oftentimes are at the center of some kind of conflict, social or cultural conflict, or real progress, and or those with strong ideas who advance new ideas or somehow in a religious setting offer new theological systems or ways of looking at religion. And I don't think any of those things really describe Thomas S. Monson. Mm. Now, it could be, of course, as time goes on, that more and more scholars look back at his long tenure in church leadership and find interesting things to talk about. But I think the kinds of things that scholars are normally drawn to are not the kind of life and ministry that Thomas Monson had. His was much more pastoral than theological. And as you mentioned at the outset, he didn't publicly or take a public position on many of the conflicts and controversies that the LDS Church has been in during his presidency or really in the 50 years of his church leadership.
Gregory Prince, it wouldn't be fair to call him a placeholder, though. I mean, there were placeholder presidents who had these short terms. His was a fairly long term in the scheme of things, although he was, as I said, seemed more passive, but not a placeholder, do you think, or was he?
In his later years, certainly he was, as his health declined. The word that comes to mind when I think of him is conservative, not in a political sense, but in conserving, in preserving the received order of things. He loved the past. He was very nostalgic, and he held on to the past to an extent that few of his peers, I think, have done.
Andrea Radke Moss, does that resonate with the way you're thinking about it? I've heard him described numerous times this past few days as a traditionalist.
Yes, that would gel with how I see him as well, because he was so young when he was called to be an apostle, and so long ago, I mean, 1963, he represented a transition between a very, very old guard who were still alive when he was a young apostle to now 2017. And so his tenure has literally transcended a half of a century, but he consistently did look back to a lot of nostalgic like ideals, not just in his storytelling, but also in the ideals that he upheld of tradition and his celebration of America and traditional values and those kinds of things. So, yeah, I see him very much looking back in a lot of ways.
I want to play a clip, just a moment, and just a brief excerpt from a talk that he gave. This was back in 1994. But I've heard a lot of people also say that you could transplant a talk that he gave in 94 and that he gave in 74 and that he gave in 2004, and there wouldn't be that much of a difference, in that these were, as I think Patrick mentioned, pastoral stories. And I want to give people who don't know or aren't familiar with Thomas S. Monson a sense of kind of his cadence, as well as the theme of a lot of the way he spoke. Here's just a moment from, this is October of 1994, the LDS General Conference.
One evening at Christmas time, my wife and I visited a nursing home in Salt Lake City. We looked in vain for a 95-year-old widow whose memory had become clouded and who could not speak a word. An attendant led us in our search, and we found Nell in the dining room. She'd eaten her meal. She was sitting silently, staring into space. She did not show us any sign of recognition. As I reached to take her hand, she withdrew it. I noticed that she held firmly to a Christmas greeting card. The attendant smiled and said, "I don't know who sent that card, but she'll not lay it aside. She doesn't speak, but pats the card and holds it to her lips and kisses it." I recognized the card. It was one my wife, Frances, had sent to Nell the week before. We left Maytime Manor more filled with the Christmas spirit.
And so it goes, this story. And I think Patrick Mason this was what he was known for. I mean, this was the general theme of, I think this is how most people are going to remember Thomas S. Monson. These stories were, they could be kind of gripping, and they were always simple and basic and kind of like that. I mean, that seems to describe Thomas S. Monson almost more than anything, is a story like that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You know, there's a passage in the New Testament that says that pure religion involves caring for the poor and reaching out to the widows and the needy. And that was what you got with Thomas S. Monson. It reaches back to his time very early in his life, in his 20s, as a bishop over a ward in downtown Salt Lake City that had scores of widows. Mm-hmm. And that became the hallmark of his ministry, and that's what he talked about over and over and over again. And it's interesting, as I've sort of listened in on Mormons reminiscing on what they're going to remember about him and how he has touched their lives, this is what comes up, is the ministry to the lonely, to the widows, to the poor, the importance of reaching out one by one, not these kind of grand pronouncements or you know, kind of big social controversies, but the importance of individual ministry.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. I think on that theme, let's take a call from Jeff, who's joining us from Salt Lake City. Jeff, welcome.
Hey, Doug. Just a quick comment. As I would watch General Conference, I'm a member of the church. I would never think that there was going to be anything directional or groundbreaking that would come from the prophet. And it was kind of disappointing to go into each conference knowing there's so many issues and controversies, but we're not going to there's not going to be anything that that would be able to get into or anything that would be really helpful for things like that. And for me, that was a little disappointing and not much to look forward to.
Jeff, I'm glad you called. I want to get Gregory Prince, you and Andrea Radke Moss on that point, because it's almost a shame you can't put aside the other complicating factors in his legacy. Is, you know, cognitive decline, the controversial LGBT policy, the intrigue about factions, all that other stuff. And just look at his stories. That's great, but it seemed, as Jeff sort of said, a lot of times you wanted Latter-day Saints, active Latter-day Saints, wanted something more from their leader. Gregory Prince?
Yeah, a president of the LDS Church ideally is filling two basic roles. One is the prophetic role, the other is the bureaucratic role. Hmm. And clearly, President Monson leaned towards the prophetic. It was an authentic walk that he walked. There wasn't duplicity about it, but he just never seemed to have much inclination to go the bureaucratic route and, as you say, to tackle these very difficult questions that not only remain unresolved, but I think they have become more complex because of the inaction during his administration.
What was he like? What was his personality like? I know that he had a public persona, even in the public, I've heard untold stories of him coming over to a table at a restaurant and telling a story or saying something kind. So I get that part of it. Was that what he was like? Is that I've also heard stories I should mention that he could be kind of mean from time to time to subordinates, that he could be awfully demanding at times. Grouchy, I think, is a term I also heard. What do we know about his personality, I suppose?
Well, I think that both of those statements that you made are backed up by what I've seen or heard. I've talked to a lot of people who have worked in the church office building, and they talk frequently about the short fuse that he had and how he could be very demeaning to subordinates.
Patrick Mason, do you have a sense of the give and take of a personality of someone like Thomas Monson? What can you say about that?
Well, I mean, you know, I've heard the same thing. You know, I never had any personal interactions with him, so it's all secondhand. But I've heard much of the same thing. I mean, that there were the two sides of him, which, you know, that's true of most human beings. And he spent most of his life in church leadership, and I think there actually are some interesting statements. I think Greg's right that he didn't lean towards the kind of policy and protocol side of things. But on the other hand, he was a master of the church bureaucracy, and had so many different assignments in the different offices within the church administration that, I mean, there's no part of the operations in that building, in the church headquarters, that he didn't touch in some way. And so and he had a very demanding job, and so whatever parts of his personality were there certainly would have been brought out by all those years of leadership.
I heard the Mormon scholar and historian Matthew Bowman being interviewed on the Salt Lake Tribune podcast, Mormonland. He said that Monson was crucial in creating, I think he put it this way, the modern Mormon church, creating the Mormon church that we know today. Anything to say about that? His supposed gifts as an administrator, creating the correlation, I think, is something that comes up from time to time.
Yeah, again, I'm like Patrick. I didn't have much personal interaction with him. The people that I knew, people I know that knew him personally, seconded much of what both Greg and Patrick have said. As far as his involvement, I think that his was very much a public persona versus behind-the-scenes private role, that he was very involved in so much of the church bureaucracy and decision-making. From what I know, he actually did maintain very, very strong opinions on a lot of issues. But again, those strong opinions didn't necessarily come out in his public discourse, which was much more ministerial. So behind the scenes, I definitely see him as an individual who was energetic and involved in a lot of how the church has run in the correlative type of programs of the church, certainly.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Jim is with us in Salt Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I grew up in the neighborhood and in the same ward that the Monsons lived in from the time I was a little kid till I got married, and grew up with their son, Clark. And we had kind of a tradition that Elder Monson would come speak in church most Christmas times, and what I learned to know about him through that experience and through just being in their home and being around their family, the stories really never changed. The story of the train car, the train set that he'd got, and they'd gotten a train set for another less advantaged person that they gave it to him, but he liked the caboose on the other kid's train car and demanded it and then felt bad and took it to the kid later in Christmas. And, you know, we got that story probably 6 out of 10 times at Christmas. But what it did for me was give me a sense of his authenticity. He was predictable, but he was honest. And there was other general authorities that were popular speakers. They had a different story for every occasion, and it came out later. And as a kid, I knew this person was just, I mean, they were watching Saturday afternoon Westerns and making stories to fit their lives out of that or something. I don't know, but you know, they were too good to be true. And then Elder Monson was just comfortably honest, and you trusted him because he didn't make stuff up.
Yeah. He had a lot of stories. And that's so interesting that he would tell stories again and again. And that came to be, I don't know if this is the quite proper segue into this question, but it seems an important one. How much of a defining factor was his health? Let me put that to you, Gregory Prince, first. How much of a defining factor was his apparent dementia? It seemed to, and you know, how much of a vacuum in terms of leadership did it create in those years, and how crucial was it that he was really disconnected from, frankly, from reality for some significant portions of that time?
I think it was crucial to an extent that only history will start to inform us. If you look at one metric of fitness to serve at that level, which is the General Conference of the Church, you can see a year after he became president that it started to wane. 2009 was the last time that he conducted one of these sessions of General Conference. And then progressively, you could see that his participation in the General Conference tailed off There were two recent ones where he gave only two brief sermonettes instead of the typical four sermons that a church president would give. And this last one, he was not present at all. There was a progressively enlarged vacuum that resulted because of his inability to continue those duties that normally he would have been able to do. And when you have a power vacuum at that level, as we've seen in the case of three other previous church presidents who were incapacitated for long periods of time, then things happen that you would rather have not happened.
Patrick Mason, do you feel comfortable commenting on this point? I mean, I wonder how much you think it constrained Thomas Monson from, you know, conceiving of initiatives within the church, and how much he would have done that in the if he had been fully healthy.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that he would have. You know, I just don't think that's the type of guy that he was or the type of presidency that we should have expected beginning in 2008. He was, as we talked about, he was a traditionalist. I think he was very comfortable with the trajectory of the church that was set by his predecessor, Gordon B. Hinckley. And so we should have expected, and we got, continuity. So I think there's no doubt that his health suffered greatly these recent years, that other leaders of the church, his counselors and members of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, stepped up and filled that role while also always deferring to him in public and saying that President Monson continued to lead the church. We don't know all of the details of his involvement day to day in the 6 months in between General Conference, but it's clear that he just was not a dynamic and vibrant leader because his health didn't allow him to in the past few years.
Andrea Radke-Moss, do you think on some level this may have made him, his health, likely to be influenced by more activist apostles and colleagues within the 12 in the first presidency?
I think that his, as Patrick said, his health decline. What was interesting to me is that even as his health was declining, that you could still see this kind of residual vibrancy in him all of the time. And so in some ways it was kind of confusing, not confusing, but perplexing. How much is he there? How much is he not there? Because you would see this, again, the public persona of he's still trying to engage. Again, I don't know. I can't really speculate on his level of involvement as far as the direction the church has taken in the last few years on some of these controversial issues. But I tend to think that he was still very involved as late as he could be, even if it wasn't an energetic kind of dynamic driving policy kind of involvement. I do think that he was involved up to probably fairly late.
I wanted to go back to this question of his what I've heard described as the gifts of his role in terms of an administrator. I wanted to get a sense of what Patrick Mason, you've said that you think that he presided over the global expansion of Mormonism in a way no other leader has, you said. So explain that, because I think there's some sense that a lot of this stuff was happening around Thomas S. Monson, some of these initiatives, some of these policies, but that he wasn't consciously driving them. He was letting himself be influenced. He was acceding to them as president, of course, but these weren't his own. And I wanted to get your opinion on that. What do you think?
Well, hopefully at some point the documents will become available for us to be able to analyze and answer that question fully. In the future. But it's, I mean, if you just look at the numbers, it's remarkable what happened during his 50-plus years in church leadership. I mean, the church goes from about 2 million members to about 16 million members. Mm-hmm. It goes from, I think it was like 12 temples when he's called as an apostle to nearly 160 today. I mean, it's and spreads all around the world. I mean, the past 50 years has been the period of Mormonism's globalization. And he was there for all of it, was did he always have his face or voice out in front of these things? Not necessarily, but they weren't happening without his knowledge and without his active participation. As I said, he served on virtually every committee that the church has for its senior leadership. So he was right out there in front in terms of missionary work, temple and family history work, you know, all the kinds of things that the church has moved forward on in the past 50 years. He was involved. And, you know, one way to read it, again, right now in a very early take, is that maybe he was a guy who didn't need to be the public face of all these things, that he was content to work within church administration or church headquarters to advance the interests of the church. But he didn't always have to be the one, you know, taking the camera or the microphone or the spotlight.
Gregory Prince, what do you think about that?
Well, there's a difference in my mind between being on the boat and steering the boat. Yes, he was on the boat for 50 years, but I don't see a lot of evidence that he did much steering. Part of this came about because of a major step in modernization that he had nothing to do with, but that certainly involved him as a participant later on, and that was the transformation of the church basically from a monarchy to a constitutional monarchy. This happened after the death of David O. McKay, and much of the bureaucratic function of the church that previously had been directly under the First Presidency was shifted over to the Quorum of the Twelve, so that the president of the Quorum of the Twelve effectively became the prime minister, the head of government, and the church president was the head of state. Thomas Monson spent 23 years as a counselor in the First Presidency before he became president, and as such, he really was removed from most of the bureaucratic functioning of the church.
Does everyone agree with that? Andre Radke Moss and Patrick Mason, do you agree with that?
Patrick, I'll let you take that question first.
Well, The fact is that we're all speculating a little
bit
here, right? You know, I mean,
but Patrick, hold on, because I want to explain this. I think what's interesting about this to me is going to be the coming question of who's going to be in the first presidency under it's going to be the presumption here is, of course, Russell Nelson, and whether or not it's going to continue to be Dieter Uchtdorf and Henry Eyring. And so the importance of the roles that these counselors play in the first presidency, I think, is not irrelevant to the question of the coming administration.
Right. And that's where, I mean, I like the way that Greg framed that. But I would push back a little bit in the sense that I think the first presidency remains very, very important. So maybe it's not quite so much the absolute monarch where it's the president of the church. Again, the health of the presidents of the church, with the exception of Gordon B. Hinckley in recent years, has not allowed them to fill that role of absolute monarch. But the first presidency as a unit involving those counselors does matter. I mean, they have to put their stamp of approval on, you know, virtually everything that runs through the church. They are involved. And yes, much of the day-to-day work of the church devolves to the Quorum of the Twelve and then the 70 and the other leaders of the church. But the first presidency is still very involved. And when the president is less healthy or less active, that the counselors do step into that role. How that works on a day-to-day basis, the internal politics of it, the personalities, that's going to shift a little bit from time to time. But I'd be hesitant to say that the first presidency or the president of the church is a purely ceremonial position. I don't think that's what Greg was trying to say.
No, I didn't take it that way, actually. Andrea, what do you think?
Well, I would agree with Patrick. The difficulty here is that there is so much speculation on our part, not knowing all of the behind-the-scenes mechanisms. But I think where you're going, Doug, is this kind of larger question of where do we go from here?
Yeah.
Because we're at this transition spot of we've had this loving, generous, ministering type of prophet, and yet the church has gone through a lot of fracturing in the last 7, 8, 9 years, a lot of fracturing mm-hmm. over all of these, you know, hot button issues. And so people want to know, is the trajectory of the leadership, the next first presidency, whoever's going to take this over, are they going to move us in a perhaps quote unquote more progressive direction, or are they going to be digging in? Are they going to be more traditionalists? And honestly, I mean, it could go either way. As we all know, there are different personalities within the highest leadership of the church. I don't necessarily think the traditional versus progressive binary falls along the age spectrum. I think there are other issues there. And so there is definitely precedent for retention of the current counselors in the first presidency. That has happened in the past. That's mostly what's happened in the past. But there's also the possibility that the counselors could be released and new counselors could be called. And where that could go, none of us could know. But it does leave people wondering what, you know, how is the church going to move forward from this kind of seemingly fractious period?
Let me, do you worry about that, Andrea?
I worry about a lot of things, so I'm going to be kind of circumspect on that question.
Yeah.
But yes, I do have, I guess, vested interest in what direction that the church might go on some of these things, yes.
I don't want to come across as cryptic here. Let's just say, and I don't want to oversimplify this, there are certain, Andrea used the term personalities. Others have described factions. And maybe if you think about it in ideological terms, you have the more doctrinaire factions and you have the more quote-unquote progressive factions. You have the kind of Hubie Brown types, and this is maybe getting into the weeds too much, and then you have the kind of Boyd K. Packer types. And the question is, who's going to rise to the top as Russell Nelson apparently will become president of the church? Gregory Prince and Patrick Mason, what do you two think about that?
Well, when I was doing the research for the McKay biography, I interviewed people who spoke not just of President McKay, but of subsequent presidents. And they gave me several eye-opening stories about how a certain individual had been very dogmatic before he became church president. But once he moved into the president's chair, things changed. I spoke with Ed Kimball when he was working on his father's biography, and he said, up until the time Harold B. Lee died, my father was the greatest follower in the church. He would never have considered changing anything. And then one day he woke up and realized he could no longer follow. He had to lead. So whatever their personality, whatever their history has been prior to sitting in the president's chair, I think we'd be well advised to give them some slack, because sometimes there are surprises once they start sitting there.
Patrick, final word on this point.
But I'd certainly agree with that. And you know, the leadership is constantly changing. The next president of the church, presumptively Russell M. Nelson, will have the opportunity to appoint two new apostles. And so there is this constant churn. Mm. And look, Russell M. Nelson is 93 years old, and, yep, and we don't know what to expect there. We can look at his track record up to this point. But Greg's point is a good one, that the past is not always a predictor for what a person's presidency will look like.
Andre Radke-Moss, we're going to lose you here soon because I know you've got to be somewhere else. So let me ask you, before we head to a break, how do you describe Thomas Monson's attitudes about women? I mean, that was one of those hot-button issues that came up, of course, during his tenure, the role of women. And there has been, you see women now speaking in General Conference, which is significant for Latter-day Saints, women asking for more responsibility, some women asking for the priesthood itself. So how has Monson fared in that way, do you think?
Well, I think it comes back to what we talked about before, is that his overt opinions or his overt ideas about the place of women and the role of Mormon feminism and asking for changes for women in the church, we can't really pin down, because he did not speak directly to any of these current events that happened in the last 5 to 6 years. What we do have is one significant pronouncement from the pulpit, lowering the missionary age for women. And I think that in the long run, Mormons respond very well when change happens from a pulpit. That's a lot of Mormons, that's what they will remember when a policy change or something was announced from a pulpit. They won't necessarily remember these smaller changes behind the scenes. Women can now pray in general conference. We're going to now call the women's session a session of general conference, these small outreach. But they will remember that he was the prophet that lowered the missionary age. And whatever the legacies of that will be, we still have yet to see how that's going to play out. But it has certainly led to a larger number of sister missionaries. It has led to increasing leadership positions for sister missionaries in the mission field, which most missions, including mine, didn't have nothing like that in the past. And so perhaps that one change is what he's going to be remembered for. But I still hold that he was very much a traditionalist when it came to gender roles, when it came to the place of women in the church. This is borne out by a lot of his talks. He also was very much interested in the kind of male organizations of the church. He was very interested in the scouting program. We have significant examples of him speaking directly to priesthood sessions, to scouting programs, to the young men, and not quite as much of him speaking directly to the women of the church. But I still think his longer legacy will be that people will remember this pulpit announcement about the missionary age change.
All right, I want to shift gears a little bit. I need to take a break. I'm going to get in trouble if I don't. Okay, Andrea Radke-Moss is a professor of history at Brigham Young University, Idaho. Joined us from her home in Rexburg. Grateful that you could take the time this morning, Professor. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me, Doug.
And Gregory Prince is with us, biographer, historian, author of the forthcoming book, Mormons and Gays. We have Patrick Mason with us, chairs the Mormon Studies program at Claremont Graduate University. We'll take a break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the life and legacy of Thomas S. Monson, who died at the age of 90 on Tuesday. Monson had been president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for 9 years. Really, though, as we've been talking about, he'd been involved in church administration for most of his life. And as Patrick Mason has pointed out, he served as a church apostle for almost a quarter of the history of Mormonism. Patrick Mason is an historian and the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University. He's joining us from a studio at Claremont. Gregory Prince is an independent historian and author of the forthcoming book, Mormons and Gays. He's joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Let me ask you, is there any question in your mind, the two of you, that Russell M. Nelson will be the next president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
There's no question in my mind. I think the tradition is very well set at this point. It could change, but it's not going to change in the next 2 weeks.
Let me ask, I just want to read a comment because I thought this was interesting. It's from Tony, she says, I'm not a member of the LDS Church, but I've always had this question. Would a president ever voluntarily relinquish his position due to health? And I'll just throw in age for that reason. And Tony mentions even Pope Benedict went contrary to church tradition and history when he resigned his position. Something like that conceivable, Gregory Prince, in Mormonism?
Yes, it is conceivable. We do things the way we do them because we have done them that way, not because there's any scriptural mandate that we have to do them that way. We have changed the way we define the senior apostle three times. The last time was over a century ago. So the successor has always been the senior apostle, but the definition of that has been fluid. And there's no reason I can think of that things couldn't change. But I think that it would require a Mormon counterpart to Pope Benedict to do it. I think it would have to be top down, not bottom up.
And that's not Russell Nelson?
Don't know.
Don't know. Okay. The New York Times has an article from Laurie Goodstein from yesterday that says this: Mormons don't do succession drama. When the head of their church dies, the next leader is chosen from the top ranks. The system is intended to avoid any hint of instability or intrigue, but it practically guarantees that the president will be elderly, even very elderly. Patrick Mason, you pointed out, Russell Nelson's 93. I think the church website mentioned, but he still has not until recently gone skiing. He's a pretty healthy 93, but he's 93. That's old.
Well, you look at actuarial tables, you know, and we probably shouldn't plan on a 20-year Russell Nelson presidency. Yeah. So the question is, what will the first couple years look like, right? Will he come in with a very strong, you know, Mormon presidencies, you know, they don't do their first 100 days in office. It's not like political office. But will he does seem very healthy right now, and will he come in with energy? And I expect that he will. I expect he'll try to do as much traveling and be as active as he can early on. He's a smart guy. He's a doctor. He knows that he won't be here forever. And so I expect to see a lot of energy from him early on, but it's just not going to be a very long presidency.
If you were to guess, do you think he retains Henry Eyring and Dieter Uchtdorf in the first presidency as counselors?
Boy, I have no idea. Yeah.
You have no idea, Greg Prince, you think he does?
Okay. Yeah, there's only been one occasion since the death of Brigham Young in 1877 where a sitting counselor was released from the first presidency and resumed his position in the Quorum of the Twelve. That was Hugh Brown in 1970, and it was because, according to his grandson, Harold B. Lee, who was the de facto church president, was so upset that Brown had tried to change the policy on ordination of blacks. So once in over 150 years doesn't, or 140 years, doesn't bode well for saying that it's likely that a sitting counselor would be released, but it's possible.
Let me bring John DeLynn into the conversation. He's with us here in the studio. He has a PhD in psychology. He's creator, of course, and host of Mormon Stories. It's a podcast that looks at LDS faith and culture. His research focuses on the intersection of mental health and religion and on the LGBTQ Mormon experience. Most of you know, of course, that John was excommunicated from the LDS Church in 2015. He's joining us here in the studio. And welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be back, Doug.
President Monson was the president who excommunicated you. How do you feel about that? I mean, what are your you must feel fairly conflicted about.
Yeah, the word I wrote down was ambivalence. President Monson inspired me deeply as a young man. Some of my most spiritual experiences as a Mormon teenager came from his talks.
What about them? Just the pastoral, simple, compassionate quality of them?
He called me to honesty and integrity and service, and in so many ways that informed and forged my work with Mormon Stories later on.
Ironically.
So I feel very ambivalent about him personally and about his administration. Personally, he's touched me. He's touched very close family members of mine. I respect what he's done. And I did appeal my excommunication, and the first presidency rejected it. So in a very direct sense, he did excommunicate me.
Yeah. Why ambivalent, though? I mean, what role do you think? I mean, there are those who think that that Thomas Monson was just influenced by a group of activist advocates within the 12, people like Dallin Oaks, to create this November policy that was so polarizing, to really go aggressively at the issue of same-sex, you know, marriage and LGBT issues, and that he was kind of just passively hearing that out, although, as it's been expressed on the show today, he did have his own opinions and expressed them, if not publicly. What do you think about all of that?
Yeah, I was thinking about the timeline of when he first took office, and if I'm not mistaken, it was 2008. And the first thing that comes to mind in 2008 is Proposition 8. And that was one of the first major decisions that he made as president of the church. And
to be actively engaged in the Prop 8 argument.
Yeah, and there's been incredible damage as a result of that. So that has to tell us something. Andrea was saying that, oh, we don't have many public pronouncements by him, so his legacy is a little bit unsure. But no, we do have the policies and the practices of the LDS Church since he's been president.
And you have to take that as a pronouncement, a de facto pronouncement by a president? Is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying that if you look at the lens that Boyd K. Packer gave us of sort of gays, feminists, and intellectuals as being the great enemies of the church, you look at what he's done with LGBT people. Yes, they've backed off on reparative therapy. Yes, they've backed off on encouraging celibacy and mixed orientation marriage. Yes, they have the Mormon and gay website. Those are positive things. Yes, they endorsed the Love Loud concert during his administration. On the flip side, they've implemented policies that in many cases are deadly And we've seen suicide rates rise dramatically from 2008 when President Monson took office to now. Now, I am not saying that President Monson is the cause of suicides, but someone who would say that the LDS Church policies have nothing to do with the increase in suicide rates in Utah, I would question that sort of decision as well. But one thing we're totally not mentioning is the intellectual part. So we talked about women. He did excommunicate Kate Kelly, but he also did make positive advancements with women. But as far as sort of people who are talking and speaking openly about the church and doubting and questioning, on the positive side, we have the gospel topic essays that came out under him. We have the Joseph Smith Papers Project. Unparalleled transparency for the church, but in some sense it was because he and the church had a knife against their throat, which was the internet. And the dark side of that is the excommunication of people like me and Jeremy Runnels and others. And I think that's really done a lot of damage to the church. And something we're not mentioning is the LDS Church experienced the largest apostasy of its membership since the 1830s, according to Marlon K. Jensen, who was former church historian. And so the decisions that the church has made with intellectuals, people who doubt, people who question, have been in some ways disastrous for the church, for its membership, for its activity rates, and the church is going to continue to suffer. If you look at a blog called Komora, which talks about LDS church growth and memberships, we're seeing the collapse of the church in Europe. We're seeing steady declines in South Korea, in Netherlands, Belgium, Russia.
Western Europe, a lot of the developing countries are growing, though, right? I mean,
even Mexico and the Philippines are experiencing slowing growth. Same with Australia and New Zealand. And West Africa seems to be the only thing that's kind of statistically keeping the church afloat in terms of membership.
Well, let me Patrick Mason and Gregory Prince back in on this question, because it really gets to what is the challenge for Russell Nelson, again, presumably the next Latter-day Saint prophet, in terms of that question, in terms of transparency, in terms of dealing with young Latter-day Saints finding questions raised about the historical accuracy of certain elements of the truth claims of Mormonism. Patrick Mason, how are you thinking about that? And then to you, Gregory Prince.
Well, I think it's certainly true that what we have not had the past 9 to 10 years in President Monson is somebody who took the public lead on saying this is where the church is at, and hey, you know, there's a place for you, and reaching out to the left, to the right, you know, and that's not what we got from President Monson. And so it had to happen from some of his counselors, had to happen from some of the members of the 12, and so we did see a variety of pronouncements, some more conservative, some more centrist, or even liberal and welcoming, but not from the president of the church. So I think one of the challenges that the church leadership has at the very highest level is, are we going to get that from the president of the church? Is the president going to be the place that, you know, or the person, the office that really steers, as Greg said earlier, steers the boat and says, this is what the church is, and this is our identity. Now that can be a little dangerous, because if you define it in one way, it could leave out an entire segments of people. And so in some ways, President Monson allowed that there was a bit of a vacuum there where people could all identify or not. But the question is for Nelson or any of his successors, are they going to take a strong stake and stance in terms of where the church is going publicly?
Gregory, hold on. John, what do you think?
Do you think Russell M.
Nelson is going to be that? I mean, he did give this speech in 2016, which essentially burnished this November LGBT policy, calling it revelation. That was seen as significant by observers. So what do you think?
About Nelson, his presidency?
Yeah, about whether or not he's going to be an activist on that issue or others.
This is tricky because we keep focusing on what the prophet says, and I'm much more interested in what the church does than what the prophet says. President Hinckley was a master at public relations, and he could say all sorts of encouraging positive things, but what concerns me is what policies the church takes and how those implement or affect anxiety, depression, suicide, divorce in the lives of its members. And so Nelson could become the next Dieter Uchtdorf, or he could become the next Boyd K. Packer in terms of his rhetoric. But
all that matters is what
happens. That matters is if the church changes how it behaves.
Gregory Prince, what do you think?
There have been three great social movements in the United States during my lifetime. I was born in 1948. They were the civil rights, women's rights, and gay rights. The nation can't claim victory yet on any of those three, nor can the church. We've talked about the LGBT issues a bit. We've talked about women's issues. We haven't talked at all about race. And to me, a shouting deficiency in the church is, where are the people of color in the hierarchy, particularly African Americans?
They've got a chance now, Greg Prince. They've got two openings, right? What do you think?
We have never had an African American general authority. We have never had a person of color in the Quorum of the 12.
You mean apostle. He means apostle.
Yeah.
No.
What about Alvesio Martin?
African-American general authority at any level. We've had black Africans. We've had black Brazilian.
Right.
We have not had an African-American. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and I'd love to see President Nelson, President-elect Nelson, if you want to call him that, grab some of these things and move the needle forward.
So what do you, that's interesting. John, what do you think about the opportunity now for a new President Nelson to appoint two new apostles? A lot of people thought when there were three apostles with three openings not so long ago that you would get some diversity. It absolutely did not happen. None of the three that were chosen really lived that far off the Wasatch Front, if ever at all. And I thought that was kind of interesting. A lot of observers have taken note of that. But now there's an opportunity. I wonder if this is going to be a sign or a signal.
I have always felt like the barrier to having non-U.S. people become apostles is that the church is such a massive conglomerate of assets and you know, financial investments, that as soon as you appoint someone not from the U.S. into the apostleship, you're basically putting them in line to become the president of the corporation of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and owning all the massive corporate and financial interests that the church has. And so I don't know how they would ever want to give that up to someone who wasn't from the U.S. And there just aren't a lot of African-American Mormons who are at that level in the U.S. So I can see – or people of color, Hispanics, Latin Americans, et cetera. So, I just want to say that – you know, who they pick as apostle will be very crucial. You know, a lot of us are very scared about an L. Whitney Clayton sort of apostleship. He's the man.
What does that mean?
He was the man behind Prop 8 in many ways, behind Ballard and Nelson. He was behind the excommunication of Kate Kelly and myself and Denver Snuffer and others. And picking him versus somebody who might be like a Marlon Jensen, very progressive and thoughtful and sensitive, will tell us a lot about the direction we're going.
Patrick Mason, we're about out of time. I'll leave that question to you finally. What do you think? What is the choice of these two new apostles going to say about the future of Mormonism?
Well, it does matter because these people will be the senior leaders of the church for the next 20, 30, 40 years, and so they'll help shape it. You know, I think the last thing that I'd say is to remember that most Mormons, you know, the people who care the most about the president of their church, they don't see that office as political. They see it as pastoral, as ministerial. They see that person as a prophet, seer, and revelator, as somebody who speaks for God and leads the church. And so we have to keep that in mind. I mean, people have deep affection for the prophets and mostly see them as faith leaders, not as politicians.
It's Patrick Mason. He chairs the Mormon Studies Program at Claremont Graduate University. Patrick, thank you for taking the time again.
Thanks, Doug.
Gregory Prince, biographer, historian, author of the forthcoming book, Mormons and Gays. Gregory, thank you.
You're welcome.
And John DeLynn, good to see you again.
My pleasure. It's an honor, Doug. Keep up the great work.
Thanks so much. Creator and host of the podcast Mormon Stories. We have a link to it on our website. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tiff Slover. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.